Last summer, the Supreme Court struck down major parts of the Defense of Marriage Act, igniting a wave of cases challenging state bans on same-sex marriage. Earlier this summer, the Tenth Circuit U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals issued a ruling striking down Oklahoma's ban on same-sex marriage. And last week, the Fourth Circuit Court followed suit with Virginia's ban on same-sex marriage. Tomorrow, the Sixth Circuit Court in Cincinnati will hear five different cases challenging the laws against same-sex marriage. Here to speak with us about the laws surrounding the court decisions on same-sex marriage and the cases in front of the court tomorrow is Professor of Law at Moritz College of Law at The Ohio State University, Mark Spindleman. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. You know, this, as we were talking before the show, this is a story that's been in the news a lot. It's hard to find somebody who doesn't have an opinion, but let's take a step back and really kind of set this up. Where did these cases come from, and what seems to be the thrust of where of what they're trying to say?
All right. So the oral arguments that the Sixth Circuit is going to be hearing this week involve not just a challenge to a single state's ban or bans on same-sex marriage, but challenges from a variety of states that makes the case or cases a little unusual. It's ordinarily you hear a challenge to one state law, not a series of challenges in a number of cases all at the same time. So the question, there are two main questions that the court is going to be considering, both of which circle around the permissibility of state laws that refuse to recognize same-sex marriages. One set of challenges involves individuals who have gone out of state to get married in a state where marriage is legal and return to a state and ask the state where they ordinarily live, we would like you to recognize our valid out-of-state marriages, just like you would if we were cross-sex couples. The other kind of challenge involves a claim about whether individuals have a right to not have to go out of state to get married, but have a right to get married under the laws of the state in which they reside. So those are the two main kinds of challenges that the cases are going to be asking the Sixth Circuit to consider.
Let's speak for a moment about the judges that are sitting in the court on this case. There are three judges. There's Jeffrey Sutton of Columbus, Deborah Cook of Akron. The third member of the panel is Senior Judge Martha Craig Daughtry of Tennessee, who is a Bill Clinton appointee. Do you think we can in any way predict the way these judges will rule? I hate to put it in the sense of based on politics, but what they're at least from what their past rulings and judgments have been.
Sure. So I think there are a lot of people who try to figure out, in a sense, triangulate what the court might do based on whether the judges are so-called conservative judges or so-called liberal judges. But part of what's interesting and important to think about in the context of same-sex marriage is that the main cases by the Supreme Court of the United States that are going to be shaping the Sixth Circuit's ruling in these marriage cases before it this week are decisions that have been written by Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is a conservative justice. So although you might ordinarily think, oh, conservative justices might be predisposed to go this way, liberal judges might be predisposed to go that way, in this case, the key precedents are written by a conservative justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. And so I think it's important to recognize that the judges are really going to be trying to grapple with what that conservative justice meant in the key rulings, including the one last year involving an important provision of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act.
Given the fact that under ideal conditions, you want to have most judges are going to basically follow precedent law. But given that, how much latitude do you see them taking just to kind of put in their own take on it? Not necessarily based on their opinion, but maybe they see something that the previous judges didn't. So how much latitude do you think they'll have, and how much do you think they'll actually introduce into that?
Okay, it's a great question. So some of the latitude involved in the case, if we want to call it that, involves an important question about how to read the maybe arguably the most significant of the recent Supreme Court decisions on lesbian and gay rights, this case from last year called Windsor, involving Section 3 of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. Now, that case struck down that important provision of that federal law on equal protection grounds. But along the way to doing so, it emphasized that part of what was unusual about Section 3 of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act was that it treated same-sex relationships differently than marriages are ordinarily treated for federal purposes. Ordinarily, if you're married for state law purposes, then the federal government recognizes your marriage. But in the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, there was a different rule that was created for same-sex marriages that were valid and recognized by the states. The federal government said, if it's a same-sex marriage, doesn't matter to us if the states recognize it or not. Now, I mention that in part because it's significant to the structure of Justice Kennedy's opinion in Windsor that state laws recognized same-sex marriage. And in that sense, the court seemed to go out of its way to say, look, we're only talking in this case about Section 3 of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. We're not saying in this decision that state law bans on same-sex marriage are unconstitutional, even though the equality or equal protection reasoning of the decision might seem and has seemed to many judges since Windsor to call state law prohibitions on same-sex marriage into question. So given the structure of the Supreme Court's decision in Windsor, on the one hand, there's a reading that many federal judges have given to the case since it came down saying, look, it's an equality case. It means that the state has to treat same-sex relationships and same-sex marriages just like their cross sex counterparts. There is some thought, and one can find this in Windsor, including in an important opinion in that case by Chief Justice Roberts, saying, look, the majority opinion in Windsor is really about states' rights, the state's authority to define marriage. That's an axiom. It's a presupposition of the court's decision that states get to define it. So there's room in that sense to read Windsor either more as an equality case or more as a states' rights case. That's the latitude, and that's what the arguments in the briefs are trying to map out. How should the court read it? So there's room to read the decision both ways, although I think the stronger reading that federal judges have given to Windsor since it came down is to read it more as an equality case rather than as a states' rights case.
Typically, how long, you know, once the judges hear the case this week, typically, how long, what kind of a lag is there between hearing the case and actually getting a ruling?
Yeah, with a case that's got as many moving pieces, and remember, we're really talking about cases. We'll call it a case,
right.
But it's multiple cases.
Five different cases, yeah.
So it's multiple cases, multiple issues, lots of precedents, lots of legal materials, lots of briefs to sort through. So I don't know that we should sort of be expecting a decision too very soon. And whatever the normal timeline is, I think it's reasonable to assume it might take the court some time longer than that to sort through all of the issues.
And let me remind our listeners, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the court challenge that's going to be heard this week in the Sixth Circuit down in Cincinnati to a number of cases that have to do with same-sex marriage. And our guest this morning, again, is Mark Spindelman, a professor of law at the Moritz College of Law at The Ohio State University. And if you've got a question or you've got a comment, give us a call. We're at 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Some observers are saying that ultimately all of these cases are going to wind up in the laps of the U.S. Supreme Court as a whole. Explain to us how would that happen, and would it take and how long would it take for the to really reach their to reach their court?
Well, we've already got a few appellate decisions, as you were describing at the top, that have come down, and those cases are working their way through the judicial pipeline, and so one of the parties the cases are going to be appealed eventually to the Supreme Court of the United States, and I think it's fair to expect that the court will decide to hear one of those cases before too very long, whether it's this upcoming term or the term after that, I think, remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Let's put this in human terms. I've got neighbors. I've got a couple of neighbors, that are same-sex, in a same-sex relationship. Another couple that I know that went to New York and got married. There was also the recent ad that just started appearing on television here in Ohio with the two older gentlemen that had been a same-sex couple and also went to New York. Put yourselves in their shoes. What should they be looking for? What should they be hoping for? And what do you tell them about building up expectations? What do you tell them about keeping this in perspective?
It's a really great question. The legal issues that including the constitutional issues that the cases involve are complicated, and they don't track or reflect simple political preferences. And so it's important to recognize that when the courts are being asked to pass constitutional judgment on state law bans on same-sex marriage, they do so, and I think we would want them to do so, I would argue we should want them to do so, quite carefully, deliberately, and thoughtfully. This is not a simple vote that the judges take based on their preferences, political, ideological, party. They're really working through hard sets of materials with arguments, and there are lots of arguments that they will need to address in the course of deciding the case. So I think the most important thing for the folks that you're asking me to address, patience, and more patience.
How about the media? Because that's also a big element as we talked, this has been in the media a lot. How good of a job from where you sit does the media do in helping people get that perspective? I've seen both good and bad coverage, but I'm an ex reporter, or recovering journalist, I guess, to call myself. But how good of a job are we seeing from the statewide media, national media in this regard?
I actually have to say, I think the conversations that I've had and the reporting that I've seen on the cases as they've worked their way through the judicial pipeline has been quite good. First rate, I would say. The latest batch of stories that I've seen do not only involve experts and analysis coming from folks in Ohio, but nationally known experts, both in Ohio and elsewhere. And the reporters really have an understanding of what the stakes are, the human dimensions of the cases, as well as the legal arguments. It's hard, I think, because there are a set of technical legal arguments that the cases involve that are, in a sense, jurisdictional prerequisites. What that means is there, in a sense, technical legal arguments about whether the court, whether the Sixth Circuit should reach the question that everybody is understanding the cases to involve. There are arguments that are hard, that are somewhat esoteric, and so I think that trying to figure out how to keep the case in perspective poses challenges, but that the reporting on it has been really great.
And of course, the big difference between what the court considers and what the media looks at is that whole issue of of the emotions. We've got opponents that are saying here in Ohio, well, let's have a day of prayer, and let's be outside the courtroom and be put on a peaceful protest. And of course, there's opposition that'll that have been out there as well. So, you know, how does that factor in? I mean, should people try and kind of back away from some of the extraneous emotion around a case like this?
Well, I mean, I think it's very understandable. I mean, it's a reflection of many people's views, whatever side one is on. Some people will pray, some people will protest, some people will march, some people will rally. And this is their way of expressing their views about the case. Should people expect that direct action is going to translate into and so affect the judicial disposition of the case? No. But the rallying and the protests as well as the prayer vigils are really not are not undertaken with the court as the audience, but are undertaken with the public in the states that are being affected as the audience.
The court of public opinion.
The court of public opinion. Perfect.
We're going to take a break here. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Stu Nicholson, sitting in for Ann Fisher this week. 19 states and the District of Columbia allow same-sex marriage, and soon Virginia will be added to that list. Some states have changed their laws through votes, and some through state-enacted legislation, but many of the same-sex marriage battles are occurring in the courtrooms. Still with us this morning is OSU Law Professor Mark Spindelman. Mark, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.
And also joining us on the phone right now to talk about the legal arguments in favor of same-sex marriage is staff attorney with Lambda Legal, Paul Castillo. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you for having me, Stu.
It's good to have you. Good to have you on here. Let me backtrack a little bit too, and I'll ask you, Paul, to maybe talk to us specifically about the two Ohio cases that are here on the Sixth Circuit docket, and that's Henry versus Himes and Obergefell versus Wimslow.
That is correct. The initial case that was filed in Ohio was the Obergefell case, and that case really had to do with two same-sex couples dealing with a spouse who had a terminal illness and had been married elsewhere and returned to Ohio, and that was really about securing for their family the name of their spouse on their death certificate after the death of the spouses. And so it really was about recognition at a time when the families were dealing with a particular life event that was particularly horrendous. And in terms of the Henry case, that had to do with four same-sex couples on the other end of the lifespan, where you had three lesbian couples who were, through artificial insemination, expecting children, and one couple from out of state who had adopted an Ohio-born son, and were seeking, and all couples were seeking to have their children placed on the their spouses, rather, be placed on their children's birth certificate.
It's interesting to hear you talk about the circumstances of these cases, because I think it illustrates the fact that these cases are about a lot more than just whether or not a same-sex couple can get married.
Absolutely. In fact, cases around the country, you're seeing cases brought forth with incredible harms, both tangible and intangible harms, simply based on the fact that the states are refusing to recognize the couples. And this comes at a time, like as in these particular cases, where it could be dealing with particular medical events or the need for assistance or disposition of property after the death of one particular spouse. So these harms are very compelling and affect the families immensely.
Paul, let me ask you, how and why did Lambda Legal become involved in this case?
Well, Lambda Legal has been involved as and co-counsel with the Henry case with respect to birth certificates. Now, we handle a wide range of LGBT issues, youth children who are adopted, and family relationships are one of our issues, among many other issues that Lambda Legal handles. But we are involved in a number of cases across the United States, both seeking the right to marry for couples and recognition of out-of-state marriage. And so this is just part of our effort to secure for same-sex couples the right to marry and recognition.
And it's interesting, and I'll quote this was in the Columbus Dispatch yesterday. The Williams Institute of the UCLA School of Law determined that about 18,300 children of same-sex couples and nearly 52,400 same-sex couples could be affected by the outcome of these five cases. The same institute says that Ohio has about 19,684. Same-sex couples, 54% of whom are female, and more than 3,760 same-sex households raising nearly 6,800 children. Is that a point that the general public seems to forget in some of these cases? Paul, what's your take on that?
Well, I think this was a particular event that was raised by the Supreme Court last year when it decided United States versus Windsor, when it struck down the core of the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, when the court said that when the government regulates same-sex couples to second-tier status, it demeans a couple. And in particular, it said that it humiliates children now being raised by same-sex couples and deprives families of equal dignity. And so that's what you've seen in many of the cases brought forth, is the stories of the families and families with children who are really being harmed by the bans across the country.
Mark, how did this? And we may have gone over a little bit this before, but how did this expand? How did these cases expand from being, just about the effects, the impacts on couples with children, and the rights of the partners in a same-sex relationship, to the broader case of same-sex marriage?
Great question. So, the cases involved, as Paul was just helpfully describing, very targeted sets of rights claims, asking for very particular kinds of relief. But in order for the court to be able to say, yes, for purposes of a death certificate, this couple should be recognized by the state, or for purposes of children, this couple or these couples ought to be recognized as married for purposes of the state, the court had to get into deeper questions about the permissibility of refusing to recognize valid out-of-state marriages. And in answering that question, can the state discriminate? Can the state not recognize these valid out-of-state marriages? The court began to open itself up to a set of arguments that were broader than the very narrow sort of particular targeted issue that seemed to be involved on the surface of the case, or in both cases.
And a reminder to our listeners, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the five cases that will be before the Sixth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati this week, dealing with the issue of same-sex marriage and a lot of related issues connected to it. You can call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you've got a question or a comment that you'd like to put to our guests. I guess one thing that strikes me is in Paul and Mark both, we've talked about the fact that this has been very much in the media for actually a fairly long time. But it seems like all of a sudden within the last year we've seen this bang, bang, bang series of cases that have suddenly, jumped up and changed the landscape. How did this happen, and maybe why did this happen so fast? Paul, let me ask you first.
Well, I think what you're seeing is an overwhelming amount of judicial consensus across the country. The Supreme Court's decision on with regard to the federal definition of marriage played a significant part of that. But, you know, with respect to marriages, there have been cases all across the country. The rulings that we've seen since Windsor have struck down a number of rationales that the government has put forth, and many of these state bans are part and parcel of the same reasoning and rationale that the federal government had for striking down these particular laws. But with respect to the overwhelming judicial consensus, that was also at a time when you had an overwhelming number of polling suggesting that the number of Americans support the freedom to marry, and both changing the hearts and minds of people as well as the cases before the courts have resulted in these victories.
I would just add to what Paul said. I think Windsor, in an important respect, has played a part in the proliferation of cases that we're seeing. For a long time, advocates of marriage equality or the freedom to marry or same-sex marriage, depending on how one wants to characterize it, avoided bringing their cases in federal court, concerned that a decision or a case that was brought too soon could well go the other way. Windsor signaled a kind of openness to recognizing marriage equality or the freedom to marry as a federal constitutional matter that really, in a sense, if it didn't invite the subsequent cases, certainly didn't stop them.
Hey, we've got a caller on the line, David from Columbus. You got a question for our guests? David, are you there? Okay. Well, apparently our phones went belly up on us temporarily here, and we apologize for that. And any rate, but Paul, are you still there?
I am.
Okay, good. I'm glad we haven't lost you. So, any rate, what do you think, let me ask you about this, what do you think the long-term look is for the issue of same-sex marriage, as far as legalizing it? Where do you think we're headed on this?
Well, I think there's no question that everybody expects a case to land before the United States Supreme Court in the near future. And it's not a matter of if, but rather when that...
Oops. Okay. Okay. Apparently we lost Paul temporarily. We'll be trying to get him back. Mark, just kind of maybe carry on.
Finish Paul's sentence. It's not a matter of if, but a question of when. I mean, I think it's right that certainly the Supreme Court is going to have an opportunity before too very long to hear and decide one of these cases. And I think that the expectation that many folks have is that Justice Kennedy will provide the necessary vote to extend his ruling in the United States against Windsor to state-level prohibitions on same-sex marriage.
Mm-hmm. The swing vote, if you will.
The swing vote.
Yeah. Anyway, it looks like we're starting to get our phones back here, and hopefully get Paul back here soon. And you kind of started to get into this, but is it at all risky to predict what the Supreme Court is going to rule? Because, we had talked earlier about, everybody has this expectation of a conservative justice and this expectation of a liberal justice or somebody that's moderate, but a lot of times they may surprise you. So,
yeah, I mean, one of my favorite quotes, I attribute it to a Harvard law professor by the name of Lawrence Tribe, who I think was the first person I ever heard say it. He who lives by the crystal ball is bound to eat a lot of ground glass. there's an awful lot of speculation. You know, the justices. Justices can surprise us from time to time. You know, I think that if it's interesting, you know, I was reading some of the briefs the other day, and one of the arguments is that there's a fundamental right to marry that includes a right to same-sex marriage. And I remember when I was in law school, asking my constitutional law professor, hey, you know, these cases, they don't actually say they don't exclude same-sex marriage. Can you read these cases to stand for the proposition that the right to marry includes a right to same-sex marriage? And the idea back then, now this, mind you, this is quite some time ago, was no, that wasn't, you know, sort of, yes, you could read the cases that way, but that's not what the court was saying. That's not what the court meant. But the recent decisions that have come down from other circuits have taken arguments very much like that, if not exactly like that, and said that they're valid arguments. So times change, things change, with the precedents coming down and Justice Kennedy's views having evolved on these questions, the court has proceeded slowly and in ways that might have been unpredictable and unexpected.
And again, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the issue of same-sex marriage and a series of court cases that are before the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, the Sixth Circuit, in Cincinnati this week. And welcome back, Paul Castillo. We're sorry that we lost you a short time ago. Glad to see you made it back from the ether.
I did make it back. Thank you, Sue.
Anyway, Paul, you were really kind of starting to talk about the what could happen if this goes to the Supreme Court and that it is all in all likelihood, you know, as you said, it's a matter of when and not if. And we kind of picked up a little bit of that with Mark, but I want you to kind of continue your thought on where you see this going.
Sure. So I think that the cases that are before the Sixth Circuit, regardless of the decision, will certainly be appealed to the United States Supreme Court. It will join appeals which are expected from courts who have already decided, including from Oklahoma and Utah and Virginia. And there are also a number of other circuits that are getting ready to hear their circuits, states' cases. And so what you'll have before the Supreme Court is a plate of options for the Supreme Court to decide, and whether it's this next term or the term after, I think you'll see the court not dodge the question, but rather decide for the nation whether or not same-sex couples are guaranteed the fundamental right to marry across the board or to marriage recognition. And so I think that will happen in the near future, and our expectation is that the courts will address that issue square on.
And real quick before we go to a break, we've got a caller, Bill from Columbus, is on the line. And Bill, you've got a question. Why don't you go ahead and direct it at either Mark or Paul?
Yeah, before 2004, when we had the ban on gay marriage put into the Constitution, we did not have gay marriage in Ohio. So my question is, even if a court strikes down Ohio's ban on same-sex marriage, does that necessarily give us legal same-sex marriage in Ohio, or would an additional step be required, either the legislature passing a law allowing gay marriage or a constitutional amendment allowing gay marriage voted on by the voters?
Okay, that's the toss-up question. Who, you know, Paul, you want to tackle that?
Sure. With respect to the cases that are before the court right now from Ohio are recognition cases. And so the question would have to come before the court in an affirmative marriage context, but certainly they would be bound by any decision that would be made by the Sixth Circuit and certainly by the United States Supreme Court. So once the ban if it is, in fact, struck down and affirmed by the United States Supreme Court, there will be no legislative action required in order for same-sex couples to either marry or to be recognized from their marriage from other jurisdictions.
Okay, Bill, thanks for that call, and Paul, thanks for the answer on that. We're going to take a break here. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And welcome back to All Sides. I'm Stu Nicholson, sitting in for Ann Fisher. Tomorrow, the sixth U.S. Court of Appeals will hear five cases concerning same-sex marriage. And this hour, we've been talking about the laws surrounding same-sex marriage in the courts and the arguments for and against legalizing same-sex marriage. Still with us is Mark Spindleman, a professor of law at The Ohio State University. Mark, thanks again.
Thank you.
And joining us now by phone is the chairman of the board for the National Organization for Marriage, John Eastman. John, welcome to the show.
Stu, thanks for having me on the program.
Good to have you here this morning and help us provide another take on this. John, we've been speaking about the opponents of bans on same-sex marriage and the arguments that they may make in court. What are the legal arguments for keeping the bans on the same-sex marriage in place?
Well, I want to point out that it's not just a ban on same-sex marriage. It's a definition of marriage that is in line with what it has always been. For example, all of these statutes that are going to be heard or constitutional amendments that are going to be heard by the Sixth Circuit tomorrow also limit marriage, the definition of marriage, to one man and one woman. So you could just as easily say they're bans on polygamy. They are defining what marriage has always been understood to be, not just in this country, but in every culture in human history. And so what we're talking about here is redefining this core social institution that we know as marriage.
I mean, that's a very broad view, but this is a court that's taking a look at cases that are very specific.
Well, that's right, and so there are two questions: does retaining the traditional understanding of marriage, the one that's rooted in the unique biological complementarity of the sexes, the unique notion that it takes a man and a woman to raise a child, to create a child, and that society benefits when we encourage the two people that give birth to that child, that create that child, that bring it into this world, are responsible for its care and upkeep and upbringing. That's why the institution of marriage developed in every society. That's why society benefits from it, as well as the children and the parents benefiting from it. And so we're talking about whether the Constitution's due process or equal protection clauses force states to redefine that basic social institution.
Mark Spindleman, how do you react to that?
I completely understand the point that's being made. Part of what's interesting to bear witness to is how those arguments, which traditionally were extraordinarily powerful as legal and constitutional arguments, have in the decisions that have come down, particularly in the wake of United States against Windsor, have been dismissed so, I think it might be fair to say, easily, readily, if not backhandedly.
Well, look, that may be true, but the reasoning in those opinions is just both ignores governing Supreme Court precedent and doesn't follow logic.
Well, for
example, in the Proposition 8 case, Judge Vaughn Walker issues a finding of fact that procreation has never been any part of the purpose of marriage, and therefore a state's interest in continuing to foster marriage because it has an interest in procreation is not only not a compelling interest, but isn't even a rational interest. I mean, this is just kind of head-scratching stuff for a judge, a federal judge, to issue in the record a finding of fact that procreation has never been part of marriage, when in fact it is the core reason we have the institution of marriage.
Well, there are two parts to what John said. The first is that the cases are ignoring precedent, and I think that one's a hard argument to make, particularly after the Supreme Court's decision in Windsor. As far as logic goes, I think that the logic can be bound up with a traditional view of marriage, or it can be bound up with the kind of less traditional, more progressive view that is still conservative, but coming out of the pen of or the computer of Justice Kennedy for the court.
Well, yeah. So here's why I think it ignores precedent, and it ignores Baker versus Nelson, which is directly on point and has not been overruled, and it ignores Justice Kennedy's reasoning in Windsor as well. Justice Kennedy begins that opinion, the first third of the opinion, talking about how states have always been the primary authority for defining marriage policy, and that when the federal government refused to recognize a new definition of marriage that New York had come up with, that it violated equal protection for the federal government not to treat the two kinds of marriages that New York was itself recognizing as equal footing for federal purposes of federal law. But the first third of that opinion talks about how important it is and how prime the role that states always been in defining marriage. Well, if New York gets to engage in this experiment with redefining marriage to be genderless, to be about only adult relationships, why can't Ohio and Kentucky and Tennessee and Michigan, the states that are up in the Sixth Circuit tomorrow, or Virginia or Utah or Oklahoma or Texas or all these other states, continue to define marriage tied to that unique procreative ability of men and women? And the reasoning of Justice Kennedy's opinion strongly suggests they can. And every one of the courts that have rejected that have largely given the back of the hand to that fundamental first third of Justice Kennedy's opinion.
Well, but they've done it for a reason, and the reason which we can agree with or disagree with is that Justice Kennedy, who is quite familiar with and quite a proponent of states' rights and federalism principles, had the opportunity in Windsor to limit the scope of his equal protection reasoning expressly on federalism or states' rights grounds. And he expressly said, we do not rely squarely, right, on states' rights or federalism grounds for purposes of issuing this decision. It's not necessary to decide this on federalism grounds, he said, which is the reason that the lower courts that have read Windsor not to be a states' right decision, but to be squarely an equal protection decision, have done so.
And let me jump in here and remind people, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking clearly about the issue of same-sex marriage and the court cases that are going to be up before the Sixth Circuit in Cincinnati this week. If you're interested in calling in, our number is 614-292-8513. And you can also email us with your question or comment at allsides@wosu.org. And let me kind of back it up a little bit here so we're not getting too far in the weeds. A Gallup poll that was taken in May reported that 55% of Americans support same-sex marriage, and nearly 8 in 10 young adults favor same-sex marriage. Mr. Eastman, how do you make your argument in the context of what we're seeing on the polling side? Do you think?
Well, a couple of things. Almost every one of the polls has been deliberately skewed, and I can give you very specific examples. After the 2012 election, for example, Gallup did another national poll that showed for the first time a majority of Americans supported redefining marriage to include same-sex relationships. But they didn't make it a truly national poll. They overweighted it heavily on the coast. They ignored large swaths of the heartland America, where, of course, defense and support of traditional one-man, one-woman marriage is the strongest. And so it was a skewed poll designed to run a narrative. I've not looked at the questions from the May poll, but I can tweak those questions to be all sorts of things. So in California, for example, 10 years ago, they were asking the question, do you support same-sex marriage or domestic partnerships or retaining traditional marriage? And it was split roughly a third each way. Well, when they asked the same question this past year, they dropped the middle point, the domestic partnerships, and that drove people in that category to one or the other of the two other options. Both of them went up by 10 points in the numbers, but the headlines all ran, support for same-sex marriage increases by 10%. So there is a narrative being driven, and you have to dig down into it. But look, you could also say the same thing about polls on abortion back in the mid-1970s. There was stronger support for abortion immediately in the wake of Roe versus Wade than there is today. I think people come to the realization of what the truth of marriage is, those poll numbers will change back the other direction, just as the poll numbers on abortion. Well, and the truth of marriage is that it's an institution designed to foster this unique man-woman relationship and the children that are the offspring of it. And society benefits from that.
And while it's hardly a broad polling method, you know, we do have callers on the line, and one of them is Sean from Columbus. Sean, welcome to the show, and let us. What's your question? Your comment for our guest today?
Well, I think there's a hint of disingenuousness going on here with the presentation of what the purpose of marriage was. The guest knows as well as I do that marriage laws are based on property law. So that's a fact, and they need updated. That way before there was a concern with gay rights, and gays' ability to get married, there was quite a bit of fervor around the updating of the marriage laws because they are antiquated. So I don't think it's strictly about what's best for children. It's what was best for landholders back in the old times. So that's where the basis of this is. So if we really want to have a good discussion, I think we've got to go back to what these laws are based on. And that sheds a lot of light on the motivation of the laws.
Mark, how do you respond to what Sean just said?
Well, I think that Sean's point has a lot to be said for it. I think that the procreation arguments play a particular role in the cases, and it really is a question about whatever the original purpose is of marriage laws. How well do marriage laws continue to serve them? What's interesting is that the circuit court decisions, not the opinion that Mr. Eastman was talking about before, take quite seriously the possibility that marriage could aim for procreative purposes, and still find finding that, recognizing the significance of that interest, still find state marriage laws inadequate, because there are lots of people who cannot marry other than same-sex couples who are allowed to marry. And so if marriage were really about procreative purposes, then marriage would be limited to those who can and perhaps those who do intend to procreate.
So I can just imagine that regime, even under compelling interest, where the classification has to be narrowly tailored to further the compelling interest. Yes, you could get more narrowly tailored, I suppose, by having boards of review asking what your intentions on Thursday and Friday nights are going to be after you're married, and doctor's test to find out are you still fertile before you enter into this relationship. We would not tolerate that kind of infringement on privacy in order to continue to advance the procreative purposes of marriage.
But that's not the point.
So that means that this is as narrowly tailored as it can possibly be. It furthers the model that men and women are the ones that create children. They're the only people who are capable of creating children, unassisted with science, technology, and everything else. And that the state has an unbelievably important interest in fostering that relationship so that the kids that are the offspring of it do better, and that society does better as a result. And this is why we have it. Look, let me go back to the kind of key legal issue here. Does it violate equal protection to treat these relationships differently? And the first question the courts always ask on an equal protection case is, are the groups similarly situated with respect to the purposes of the classification? This is why Judge Von Walker had to say that procreation has never been any part of marriage, because if he concedes that it has been, as everybody that's honest must concede that it has been, then two men and a man and a woman are not similarly situated with respect to that purpose, and it is no violation of equal protection to treat people who are differently situated differently with respect to the purposes of the institution.
Okay, Mark, how do you respond to that?
It is true that biological procreation sort of is a natural biological difference, and it could be credited in the way that John is suggesting. I would just say, however, that the Supreme Court decisions here, I'm thinking about in particular the sodomy decision, striking down sodomy laws, Lawrence against Texas, as well as United States against Windsor, have said same-sex couples, same-sex intimacies, and in Windsor, same-sex relationships and marriages are just like their cross-sex counterparts. That's Supreme Court decision that is going to be binding on the Sixth Circuit when it's considering arguments just like the arguments that Mr. Eastman is advancing.
John, let me read something here. Recently, Republican U.S. Representative David Jolly publicly announced his support for same-sex marriage, stating, and I'm quoting here, "As a matter of my Christian faith, I believe in traditional marriage, but as a matter of constitutional principle, I believe in a form of limited government that protects personal liberty. That means the sanctity of one's marriage should be defined by their faith and by their church and not by their state," end quote. Are you concerned that we're hearing more conservatives, and we've only got about a minute left, but are you concerned that we're starting to see conservatives follow along with that line of thinking?
Well, and we've got Senator Ruben Diaz, a very prominent Democrat out of the New York legislature, coming out the other direction in very strong support of traditional marriage. He was one of the keynote speakers at our March for Marriage back in June. I think the statement you just read is just very confused about what the underlying purpose and nature of marriage is. And there's a huge difference between criminally prosecuting intimate conduct between two men. That was the issue in the Texas sodomy case that Justice Kennedy wrote. And saying that every society in this nation, every state in this nation, has to now sanctify and recognize that relationship.
Okay, we're going to have to interrupt you here. We're running out of time here. But this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And thank you to our guests.